The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
What Trayvon teaches, growing outrage over the killing of a Florida teen brings belated government action and second thoughts on Stand Your Ground.
Etch-a-Sketch politics. Was it a gaffe or a hint by Romney's top aide to moderates in the fall campaign? And catching up with Congress.
To keep touch true. How an autism expert advised the new Fox TV series, her response to critics, and to new government guidelines on the condition.
Faces of Forgetting, a new photography book and exhibits show new aspects of the mental deterioration that threatens so many of us.
Hollywood on the Block, the auction block inside a huge trove of movie memorabilia you can see online and bid on by phone.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of GateWave.org, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For Your Ears Only, for the week of March 25th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
He's got something in his hands. I don't know what his deal is.
Okay, just let me know if he does anything, okay?
Over here.
Yeah, we got him on the way. Just let me know if this guy does anything else.
Okay. They always get away.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your number?
There's gunshots.
Well, I stand by the Sanford Police Department, its personnel, and the investigation that was conducted in regards to the Trayvon Martin case. It is apparent that my involvement in this matter is overshadowing the process.
The fatal shooting of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old African-American, by suspicious Citizens Watch volunteer George Zimmerman in Sanford, Florida, a month ago, despite police advice that Zimmerman stop following the boy, exploded into national consciousness last week. Release of 9/11 tapes mixed with social media to generate widespread public demonstrations and escalated pressure that finally forced Sanford Police Chief Bill Lee to step aside, at least temporarily, while state and federal investigations began into racial motivation and misapplication of a controversial Stand Your Ground law like those now in 20 other states. President Obama himself pronounced it a tragedy and said a son of his would, quote, look like Trayvon.
Despite all that, Sanford police still have not arrested Zimmerman on charges that should eventually be tried in court. To consider the case, the controversial Stand Your Ground law, and the racial factor, for your ears only, we're joined again by veteran journalist Ellis Coase, now senior fellow at the Center for Talent Innovation. His books include Colorblind and The Rage of a Privileged Class and many others. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
How aware were you of the Martin shooting before those 9/11 tapes came out, thanks to a civil suit brought by Trayvon's family?
Sure. I mean, I was aware before the 9/11 tapes, but not much before that. I mean, there's been a drumbeat of attention that's been sort of leading up to this case. And I would say probably a couple of weeks ago when the Charles Blow column came out of the New York Times, this is one that really focused my attention on it. But there have been as you indicated in your introduction, the attention to the case had been growing through bloggers and through social media. And I certainly heard of the case early this month, but it was not until, I think, March 16th that I really focused my attention on it.
Are you surprised that this month-old case generated so much protest around the country and across color lines? Does it suggest more interracial solidarity these days, even as personal prejudice and profiling can remain a deadly threat to young black men in particular?
Well, I think it suggests that to some extent, but I think what it really suggests is that this is one of those rare cases in which there is a killing and which there are no two sides, really. I mean, on one side, you have an innocent child who has done absolutely nothing wrong, who was going to visit his father. And the other side, you have a nut job vigilante with a gun. And so even if you take the racial stuff out of this case, it seems to be a blatant case of a man with some kind of psychological issues deciding to target a young child and ultimately killing him. And I think this touches so many chords within people, whatever your race is, that you get a huge response. And then when you layer on top of that the racial aspect and the fact that you have laws all over the place which have been misused in a way that has, through at least from the perspective of many African Americans, ended up targeting African Americans. Then you have another situation where it just generates an even more intense reaction to this. So I think you have two things going on here. I mean, one, you have a case in which you have an innocent and a perpetrator in most people's eyes, and then you have the racial element as well.
So do you believe that there are still a lot of other cases like this that don't benefit from police tapes, that potentially incriminate the shooter, don't provide the peg for massive media coverage and protest that seems to have become critical here?
I don't know there are a lot of cases, but it was clear from the investigations that have been going on in the media and elsewhere in Florida and some of these other states, is that these laws do increase the propensity of people to want to use this kind of defense, this sort of stand-your-ground defense, after someone gets shot in situations that are questionable.
Yeah, in fact, Florida police brass initially opposed the law, and justified killings by citizens in that state have risen from 5 a year to 36 since the law was passed in 2005. What do you think makes these laws so appealing when even the police chiefs are against them?
The same thing that makes the carry laws appealing, the same thing that makes people become huge defenders of Second Amendment issues, and that is this view that we have that on one side, that arming good people will make them safer and will make the country safer, and the view on the other side that arming people who have no training or no real training and who have no real reason to believe that they are in harm's way will only make things more dangerous. I think, unfortunately, that divide is going to remain after this case gets resolved, however it gets resolved, because it's another version of an old argument that we've seen, which on one side has the argument going, guns don't kill people, people kill people. And the other side has the argument going, yeah, but people do stupid things, and certain laws empower them to do things. So you have people arguing two different debates, and one side justifying these sorts of policies, and the other side not. But legislators who are proposing these laws have already said they're going to continue to propose them. And even as the Republican candidates denounce this particular case, or at least criticize the handling of this particular case, they did not criticize the law itself.
How do you rate President Obama's response?
His response was, I think, interesting in many respects. One thing, I think it shows that he's learned something since a few years back when he came out on the Skip Gates case and he criticized the police action. He was very careful to make his reaction in this case a very personal reaction of a parent responding to what could happen to a child. I think it was a very effective response. I think what happened in the Skip Gates case, where he said that the police did something stupid, is that he was hit with a firestorm reaction by people who thought he was taking sides and who immediately thought he was taking sides in a way that was racially divisive. This way he avoided doing that, but I think he also made his point very clearly, which was that you have a young guy whose only crime, as far as anyone has been able to figure out yet, was the crime of wearing a particular kind of clothing garment and being black in a place where someone thought he was suspicious.
Do you see the Trayvon Martin case having any significant effect on presidential politics, maybe re-energizing Obama's minority base that has developed some doubts about him?
No, I don't think so, because Obama will have a difficult time using this case as a rallying point for his campaign. And I think because everyone thinks that Zimmerman did something suspect at the very least, and I think and everyone, including the Republican candidates, think that the police mishandled what went on in Sanford, Florida, I don't think this is going to have any real impact on the presidential election. I think what it sort of illustrates is that we are finally a country where no one is willing to defend the killing of an unarmed black kid, even if the person who kills him claims that it was self-defense.
Veteran journalist Ellis Coase is now a senior fellow at the Center for Talent Innovation. His books include Colorblind and The Rage of a Privileged Class and many others.
Quote from the news, one might wonder if there was a lapse or not. That was French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé acknowledging widespread questions about inadequate police surveillance of Mohamed Merah, the 23-year-old Frenchman of Algerian origin who was slain in an extended gun battle after killing three soldiers, a rabbi, and three Jewish children around Toulouse, France. Merah had been on a police watch list since he attended terrorist training camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Next, Etch-a-Sketch Politics and Congressional Dynamics. For your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. There's no crime scene. There's no DNA. There's no confession, although they're leaking something, which I don't believe until I see it. That was John Henry Brown, lawyer for U.S. Marine Sergeant Robert Bales, later charged with 17 counts of murder for the massacre of civilians as they slept near his base in Afghanistan. The U.S. commander for Afghanistan, General John Allen, said there would also be an investigation of the command decisions that led to Bales' fourth combat tour, despite earlier brain injury and other wounds. Allen also told Congress that troop levels in Afghanistan should not fall below 68,000 after 2012. Now this.
Thank you, Illinois. What a night. Wow.
Well, I think you hit a reset button for the fall campaign. Everything changes. It's almost like an Etch-a-Sketch. You can kind of shake it up and we start all over again.
He will say what he needs to say to win the election that's before him. And if he has to say something different, because it's a different election and a different group of voters, he's willing to say that too.
Something always seems to steal Mitt Romney's spotlight. After scoring his third straight victory in a Midwest industrial state with 47% of the Illinois primary vote versus 35% for Rick Santorum, Romney found himself sandbagged when top aide Eric Fernstrom openly predicted that Romney would pivot to more moderate positions for the general election, exactly as Santorum has been warning. And Democrats quickly created an Etch-a-Sketch TV ad to argue Romney's unreliability.
But Santorum also sandbagged himself last week, saying at one point that he didn't care about the unemployment rate because, quote, my campaign doesn't hinge on it, as opposed to controversial social issues. He also angered many in his party by suggesting that if Romney got the nomination, Republicans might as well vote to reelect Obama. In Congress, meanwhile, there was a new GOP budget plan to cut taxes and spending that could provoke another government shutdown threat as Election Day approaches. To consider all this for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Brookings Institution Senior Fellow Emeritus Stephen Hess, a Republican and Democratic White House veteran. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Always good to be back.
So was the Etch-a-Sketch remark a gaffe or a not-so-subtle invitation for moderate support in the fall campaign from a Romney team that believes his nomination is now inevitable?
Oh, I think it's a big-time gaffe. And now we have to measure how big. You know, the power of metaphor in presidential campaigns can be sensational. I mean, just remember Michael Dukakis running around in that tank with that little helmet, and after that, no one was going to turn over our national defense to him. Or even earlier on, George H.W. Bush, when he goes into a supermarket and he's never seen a
checkout scanner.
Checkout counter, that was it. Yeah, and you say, hey, this guy isn't in touch with reality. The only good thing that stands in the way of this one being another historic gaffe is that it wasn't delivered by the candidate himself. But the idea of this child's toy that's been around with us for 50 years, where you just swipe it and it erases something, is a marvelous way of playing the real problem that Republicans so far have had with Mitt Romney. Is he really a conservative? I think it's apt to fade, but it's going to be around with us for a while longer.
How do you read the delegate math at this point? I mean, can Romney be kept from the required 1144? And if so, what happens at the convention?
Oh, I think most of the professional Republicans in Washington think it's a done deal, and it's just a question of time. Even this week, Jim DeMint, who's the godfather of the Tea Party, said he certified Romney as a conservative. Didn't endorse him, but that's on the way. Pat Toomey did it from Pennsylvania this week.
And Jeb
so
Bush.
I think they're all lining up this way, and it's just a question of playing out the schedule that we have in front of us.
Was Santorum reflecting a larger truth, though, that improving employment and business conditions may undermine Republicans' economic critique of Obama?
Well, in a sense, he's right. It's sort of a teeter-totter effect. The more the economy goes up, the GOP chances go down. But the economy has been improving, but not that much. So it's still really the possibilities of an election that's based on the state of the economy and not the state of such things as abortion or whatever it might be, the social issues that Santorum has been has been pushing forward.
How do you see the campaign affected by the Supreme Court review of Obama's Affordable Health Care Act that begins this week? How does a ruling either way on it impact Democratic and Republican voter motivation?
Obviously, a victory for the president would be very good indeed. But a defeat doesn't mean that it's all over. And in fact, even a victory doesn't mean it's all over. This is a complicated piece of legislation with a lot of odds and ends in it that are difficult for the public to understand, and many of them won't be able even to realize till 2014. So this will continue to be played out in the campaign and, of course, in the next Congress.
Staying with legislation, what was your reaction to Paul Ryan's new budget proposal with even less spending than Congress had previously compromised on?
I think Ryan is a serious man, and it's shown that we really do have a difference between the two parties that'll be played out when we can get through an election, which at this point is mostly rhetoric. But in fact, I see the rest of this Congress settling down. The Republicans really want to get something done so that they don't get the reputation that Obama is happy to hang on them of a do-nothing Congress. And I think the president is sort of happy to get something done, too, so that he doesn't get the moniker of being an anti-business person. So in the past week, you've started to see little things. Some judgeships that have been tied up have finally gone through. There's been an ethics bill, or rather strange one, saying that members of Congress can't do inside trading. Well, of course, that was already illegal, so it's as if they're saying, well, it's illegal, but it's even more illegal for you guys. And there's been a jobs bill. So I start to see some coming together, which doesn't in any means represent bipartisanship. It just represents both sides feeling that they would like to lower the heat, but it's clear, though, as you point out, the Ryan budget shows that there's a lot of difference between these two parties. They both may be for debt reduction, but they sure want to do it in different ways.
What about the GOP House leadership's delay on legislation to counter the Obama plan for requiring contraceptive care in health insurance, whatever an employer's religious or moral tenets? We hear they fear further turning off women voters.
These guys want to go home, both guys and gals. They want to get out of here. They've got campaigns to run, and particularly in many cases, primary campaigns to run because of redistricting. They've been put together with in new districts, often with other members of Congress. In the Republican Party particularly, incumbents have been threatened by Tea Party folks. So they don't want to hang around here too long.
Republican and Democratic White House veteran Stephen Hess is now a Brookings Institution Senior Fellow Emeritus.
Quote from the news, for decades, consumption rose, production fell, and imports increased, and now every one of those trends is going the other way. That was Council on Foreign Relations, Energy, and Environmental Senior Fellow Michael A. Levy on increased production by the U.S. oil and gas industries and lower gas consumption, an unexpected step closer to energy independence.
Next, Keeping Touch True, the autism debate. For your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. Criminal justice today is, for the most part, a system of pleas, not a system of trials. That was Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy in his majority decision that criminal defendants have a constitutional right to effective lawyers during plea negotiations as well as in the courtroom. Now this.
Jake, the number you gave me earlier, it led me to here. Earlier this morning, there was a robbery. I couldn't stop that from happening, but I think I saved the owner's life. Was that what I was supposed to do? Is that why you gave me the number? Jake, please. I am trying so hard to do what you want me to. Just give me a sign, a hint, anything.
Hardly had earnest, steadfast Kiefer Sutherland had a chance for decent R&R after saving the world from global terrorism in the Fox TV series 24, than he's back again saving it one potential victim or perpetrator at a time. Now he's the father trying desperately to work through numerical clues channeled by a special needs son who sees all the hidden connections of life and death in the new Fox series Touch.
The show premiered in a regular Thursday night time slot last week, tying together the fates of a shopkeeper with cancer, an Indian tourist with his father's ashes, a harried airline flight attendant, and a missing dog, among others. It also added fuel to a debate within the autism community over the condition of Sutherland's son, fixated, mute, avoiding eye contact or human touch. Somewhat similar children star in Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, the novel and film, TV's Parenthood, and other current entertainments.
The creators of Touch insist their character is not actually autistic or even a high-functioning Asperger syndrome child, but they did hire an autism expert as technical advisor, Joanne Lara, founder of Autism Movement Therapy at autismmovementtherapy.org, and to talk about the series, the controversy, and pending changes in the definition of autism for Your Ears Only. She's on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
What sort of guidance did you provide on how the young boy should behave?
When they originally called me in, which was last June, I came in because the boy, as we know, is a nonverbal child with a special need, and all of his characterization, if you will, had to come through the physicality of his body. Because I'm an autism expert and I also do a movement and music program for kids with autism, I think they thought I might be a good choice. I have a degree in dance and I danced many years. So I know that physicality, if you're not speaking, you really have to convey something to the camera or we have nothing to really look at.
Did you have any suggestions for how the parent of such a child would behave and should behave under those trying circumstances?
I did. I worked specifically with Lawrence, Francis Lawrence, who was the director of the pilot. He directed Water for Elephants and I Am Legend and the boy, David Mazouz. And we really worked specifically with the characterization. I gave him a chin raised, his shoulders back. We worked with the visualization of where his eyes should be fixed. More the characterization of the boy than Kiefer himself. Kiefer, you know, he knows his way around that territory pretty well. I didn't want to pretend to be his coach.
One complaint from the autism community is that Touch, like many entertainments, is predicated on the notion that limiting effects of the condition are balanced by extraordinary talents because it's more comfortable for mainstream viewers to see it that way. Do you find such compensation in real life, the way blind people often develop their powers of hearing?
Sure, I do. And I think that, you know, in many ways, Touch is covers a lot of that kind of territory. But the writer and the creator is Tim Kring. And, you know, he's the Heroes creator and writer as well. So I think what we're looking at is more of an archetype characterization of the father, the son, and then the events that we see taking place across the planet are personal stories that we'll see each week. You'll not see those characters again the next week, and it'll be a new story.
Another complaint is that the son in Touch is really not allowed to show personal pleasure or have a private life beyond this obsessive channeling of those numerical clues. Does this ignore the individuality of such people, lead the rest of us to see only their syndrome and not themselves?
Well, again, I think that they're not trying to tell a story like the story in Parenthood, that the subplot story of a subgroup of Asperger's individuals, that they're really trying to focus more on a metaphorical or even a metaphysical kind of ideology with this child. And he represents an archetype of good and evil and a child that, with his powers, is able to divert events that may happen that could be catastrophes across the planet.
In the real world, the autism community is also concerned about a shifting definition of the condition that could affect the kind of financial resources available from insurance companies and the government. Give us a brief idea of the changes under consideration by the medical community.
Well, you're talking about the DSM-5. Right now, we are operating from a DSM-4. I personally don't think it will happen. What would happen would be that the definition of autism as we know it today, the criteria would narrow, and it would pretty much just to be working with individuals who had speech and language impairment that were very profound or in a moderate to severe area, and eliminate what we know to be as one quarter of classic autism, three quarters of Asperger's individuals, and three-eighths of PDD-NOS. So the narrowing of the criteria itself would actually eliminate services for individuals that I feel personally are individuals that with early intervention are able to contribute to society, have a job, have a path, have a community existence, if you will, an inclusive setting for themselves, but without early intervention, that's pretty iffy. So I don't think it's going to happen.
Some say simply abolishing the label Asperger's will have a psychological and emotional effect, removing a protective sense of identity, pushing high functioners into a larger group with more serious problems with whom they may not feel comfortable. What's your view on that?
Asperger's individuals have a specific challenge in the social skills area. To eliminate that group of individuals, I think, would be devastating. I think that they need the support. I think they need the recognition so that they can get the early intervention and that they have the possibility of being included in their society, getting a job, marrying, and owning a home.
Joanne Lara is the founder and leader of Autism Movement Therapy at autismmovementtherapy.org, and she served as a technical consultant for the new Fox TV series, Touch.
Quote from the news, anyone with a family history would be sensible to take aspirin. That was Dr. Peter Rothwell, a professor of clinical neurology at the University of Oxford, on a study showing significant reductions in cancer with regular use of aspirin, although frequent use can also increase stomach bleeding, brain hemorrhages, and other health risks.
Next, from youth to age, a new view of Alzheimer's for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. No one is above the game. That was NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell on suspending New Orleans Saints coach Sean Payton for the season in connection with a bounty program that paid players for seriously injuring key opponents. Goodell also fined the Saints $500,000, slapped an 8-game suspension on general manager Mickey Loomis, and a 6-game suspension on assistant coach Joe Vitt. Former defensive coordinator Greg Williams, now with St. Louis, was suspended indefinitely for running the bounty program. Meanwhile, the New York Jets acquired Broncos quarterback Tim Tebow, famous for mid-game prayer. Now this.
My whole emphasis on brain science comes in directly from dealing with the real problems of real people in my family. And so it's not a theory. It's, in fact, my mother.
A tearful reference by presidential wannabe Newt Gingrich late last year was one of the few mentions of Alzheimer's disease in the current presidential campaign, though the disease may well present the most costly challenge, financially and emotionally, to the current healthcare system or whatever version survives the Supreme Court review that begins this week. Millions of Americans who don't develop the mind and memory-destroying disease will be responsible for the millions that do.
There was more disturbing news last week in a report that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved manufacture of higher-dosage Alzheimer's drug Aricept, despite failed effectiveness tests and the advice of its own experts, thereby extending patent protection for Pfizer, but raising the risk of problematic side effects such as nausea and vomiting. On a more positive note is the new photo book Love, Loss, and Laughter, Seeing Alzheimer's Differently, by sociologist-photographer Kathy Greenblatt from Globe Pequot Lyons Press. There's also an exhibit of photos from the book at Pace University in Lower Manhattan. Now to talk about both and the new approach to dealing with Alzheimer's that they reflect, for your ears only, we're pleased to have Kathy Greenblatt on the line. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How many photos are in the book, culled from how many in all that you took over 10 years on this project?
Well, I could have counted how many are in the book, and I admit that I didn't do that. It's between 110 and 115, and I wouldn't even begin to know how to count the thousands that were taken and even the many thousands that I didn't throw out right away, and how I had to winnow them down to most effectively present something in a limited number of pages that people could pick the book up. you know, let's move it around their house.
What are some of the locations in which you photograph people suffering from the disease?
The places that have the most photographs are in the United States and in several different places in the U.S. In France, where I live a good portion of the year these days, but also in India and Japan, the Dominican Republic, and then there are a few from Canada. And there's actually one that got in there because I had just begun to photograph there from Monaco. So it's seven countries when I want to count that one, but it's more legitimately six countries.
You have a personal connection with Alzheimer's.
I do, and it's not a personal connection that I was very proud of from the beginning, but it's part of the reason this book is so important to me. I lost both my maternal grandparents to Alzheimer's when I was much younger, and my mother in the last several years. And the reason I say I'm not very proud of it is that I had all the tears and the fears that are the kind of thing that we heard from Mr. Gingrich, and which we'd hear from anybody who's watched a loved person in their family or a neighbor or a friend suffer from a degenerative brain disease. But I was only focused on the losses, and I didn't really understand anything then about how much there was that I could have done. And I only learned that later on, but I learned it in time to make a difference in the kind of care that my mother got.
When and where did you discover the new approach to coping with Alzheimer's that you set out to illustrate, maximizing the mental and emotional potential of each individual affected?
I had a knock-me-down experience in Southern California in 2001. I had just taken an early retirement from working as a professor of sociology at Rutgers, and I was starting to photograph. And I had done an initial small project on the elderly, and a friend told me that they could take me to a place that had the best Alzheimer's care they had ever seen. This friend was a geriatric psychiatrist, and that she thought that this place would be pleased to let me photograph there, which I was looking to do for the summer. I didn't dare tell her that it was the last place in the world I wanted to go, because my effective strategy for dealing with Alzheimer's and my fears of it were to run away from it and run away from any contact with it. But I thought, she won't find me another place if I say no, just sight unseen. So I went with her and found that my views, which are still very prevalent now, that the people that have Alzheimer's are basically gone, that they die two deaths, that they're empty shells, that they can't benefit very much from what we say or do, that they won't remember tomorrow anything about what we did, so we can put them in front of the television and keep them safe and cry. I mean, we can cry. And I suddenly found a place that offered stimulation, that treated them as though they were still here, that gave them celebrations, parties, talked about the news, had them listen to radio programs like yours. It was filled with touch and smiles and music. The people were completely different than I had seen my grandparents, and I realized that there was a great deal that we already knew how to do and that we could do effectively to really change the quality of their lives and in that way change the quality of our lives.
You also employed a significantly more positive approach than usual photographically.
What I decided was that most documentary photographers who are photographing some of the tragedies in our world, it's easy enough to find them, are showing just by definition the tragedies. Everybody knows what bad care is for many things, not just for Alzheimer's disease. But not enough people know that we already know how to offer good care in day centers, in memory clinics, in diagnostic situations, in homes, in residential communities, and that there are so many lessons that those of us who have a loved one can learn about how to more effectively really improve the quality of lives of the people that are affected directly and indirectly. So I thought, I'm just going to take people on a journey that they probably won't go on and show them all the positive things. And maybe that will have them demand higher standards and go to places and say, why don't we do this here where my aunt is? Or they'll learn how to do more effective communication at home. But there's lots of things we can learn to do. And I think I could have learned to do when I was younger, but there was nobody to teach me.
Kathy Greenblatt is a Rutgers University Professor Emerita of Sociology and author-photographer of the new book Love, Loss, and Laughter, Seeing Alzheimer's Differently from Globe Pequot Lions Press. 84 photos from the book are on display through April 28th, Wednesday to Saturday, noon to 6, at Pace University's Michael Schimmel Center for the Arts, just south of the Brooklyn Bridge in Lower Manhattan, and there's a major symposium on Alzheimer's April 25th.
Quote from the news, a Jewish English muffin. That was the term coined by Murray Linder, pioneer of the widely distributed frozen bagel, who died last week at 81. Also dead last week was Samuel Glazer, 89, co-founder of the Mr. Coffee automated home brewing machine.
Next, Hollywood on the Block, for your ears only.
Going, going, but not yet gone. It's For Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news, not off the table. That was the reported response of Algonquin Hotel General Manager Gary Budge to a Change.org petition demanding that he reopen its famed Oak Room Cabaret, signed by nearly 3,000 fans. Now this.
Hey, while you sleepy heads are in that hay,
be dancing with a sun-kissed baby, and I'm on my way. Here's my beret. I'm going Hollywood.
You may not find the beret Bing Crosby waved in that scene from the 1933 film Going Hollywood, but there's a trove of other movie memorabilia on display. In fact, 980 lots at Julian's Auctions in Los Angeles for one more week before the bidding next Saturday and Sunday. Included are an iconic Charlie Chaplin cane, the on-screen robe that Charlton Heston wore in Planet of the Apes, vintage Marlena Dietrich photos, Lucille Ball's TV costumes, and dresses worn by the late singer Whitney Houston. Also, lots of classic movie posters, perfect for that empty wall.
If you can't get to Julian's in person to browse and bid, you can do it online by visiting their website, www.julians.com. And on our line now with some inside stories of the auction, for your ears only, we're joined by Martin Nolan, executive director of Julian's Auctions. Welcome to our program.
Thank you so much. So great to be here and so exciting news to tell your listeners about this auction because it's the best we've ever brought to market.
Where and how were you able to locate or obtain most of these items, and how long did it take to collect them all?
We've been working on this auction. We do this auction, Hollywood Legends, every year. The majority of these items comes from a museum in Belgium. And so the gentleman that curated that museum was buying items, acquiring items, meeting with celebrities for over 30 years. And finally, he's letting go of his collection, and we're bringing it to market. So it is an eclectic collection, and it's fantastic and very diverse.
In the first week of the public display, did some items obviously draw the most interest?
Yes. One that was really of interest to people was the 12 items we're selling from the life and career of Whitney Houston, because sadly, you know, it's very recently that she passed away. And the whole eyes of the world are wondering how collectible she has come now that she's no longer performing and sadly no longer with us.
Let's talk in more detail about a few of these items, starting with the suit Charlie Chaplin wore in his film King in New York. What does it look like? How did you get it?
You know, the suit comes from that museum in Belgium, and in fact, it's dressed on a life-size wax mannequin of Charlie Chaplin just to bring the suit to life. It was made in 1952 by a London tailor, Stovall and Mason, on the recommendation of Douglas Fairbanks Sr. to Charlie Chaplin. And we estimate this at $20,000 to $30,000. It's a dark navy blue suit and pants, and it's a great item.
There's also a Charlie Chaplin driver's license. What makes that so unique?
The driver's license is, in fact, it's 38 pages. It's an international driver's license.
Ah.
And we estimate that it's from 1953 with Charlie Chaplin, his name, et cetera, on it. And we estimate that $2,000 to $4,000. We probably start the bidding at around $1,000.
And what about that cane?
Well, if you think of Charlie Chaplin, you certainly think of the cane. That's one of his very identifiable items. And this, we estimate, at $20,000 to $30,000. Again, highly collectible, highly sought after. And his canes in the past have sold upwards of $100,000.
What can you tell us about Clark Gable's riding jacket from Gone with the Wind? And what's the minimum price on that?
Again, Clark Gable is highly collectible. We can never get enough items. And Gone with the Wind is a 1939 movie, highly collectible. And we're also selling the wax figure of Clark Gable, so you can buy the wax figure separately, and we estimate that at $2,000 to $4,000. Or you can buy the jacket itself for $10,000 to $15,000. So again, he as the butler in Gone with the Wind, very identifiable. and it's a great piece.
We know where the Bible's Ten Commandments came from, but what about the imitation stone tablets from the Hollywood version, and where will that bidding start?
Yes, again, they're a great item. We also have the robe and the staff worn by Charlton Heston, and on the actual tablets themselves, we estimate 20 to 30,000.
You mentioned that the recent death of Whitney Houston has added to the value of those dresses in your collection. I wonder if the auction also benefits from the popularity and the Oscars won by Hollywood's homage to old-time movie-making The Artist.
Yes, certainly, because, you know, people are very nostalgic, and you certainly see that from the recreation of a silent movie, The Artist. People are looking for that sentimental or that historic story. And what these items do are give people a chance to own something from their icon. In this case, I'd say Whitney, who recently passed away. There's a lot of sensitivity about it and a lot of sadness around her death. And people want to own something from her and to keep her memory alive, and that's part of her legacy. So, yes, her items and, in general, items continue to appreciate in value. This has become a very serious industry. Collectibles, people, and investment money has now come into this world because, again, people's values, let's say Marilyn Monroe, 50 years since she passed away, her items continue to increase in value. And in fact, we have over 120 items of Marilyn Monroe in this auction as well.
Say more about how listeners can view the exhibit online and how they can put in bids long distance.
Yes, juliansauctions.com. You can go on and look at the auction right now. You can place bids right now. You can also look at the catalog. Just flip the catalog, turn the pages. You'll hear the pages turning, and you'll see the wonderful catalog, all the images coming to life for you. And the auction takes place in our gallery in Beverly Hills on March 31st and April 1st. So it's live streaming video. Anybody with a computer anywhere in the world, they can see and hear the auctioneer, press that button, and win some of these items.
Martin Nolan is the executive director of Julian's Auctions of Beverly Hills.
Out where they say, let us be gay, I'm going Hollywood. I'll ballyhoo things to you, I'm going Hollywood.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. Now, do you really think our country is ready for a white first lady? Too soon, right? That was a joke by Robert De Niro at an Obama re-election event quickly called unacceptable and inexcusable by GOP hopeful Newt Gingrich.
For Your Ears Only On Air is online at YouTube, iTunes, and Podcast Bunker. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donation. Please email davidearsonly@gmail.com to pledge.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at Play It Productions with interns Daniela Quintanilla and Rachel Murray. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern, acknowledging support from Gatewave.org, a nonprofit radio reading service, the century-old Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Rachel Murray. This week, last year, we celebrated a little-remembered African-American pioneer of stage, screen, and TV, Ethel Waters, from our March 27th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by David and Melissa Exelberth.
I, along with the critics, have never taken myself very seriously. My craft, yes, but as an actress, no. But I wasn't all that bad, was I?
That was Elizabeth Taylor receiving the 1993 American Film Institute Lifetime Achievement Award. A two-time Oscar winner, Taylor died last week at age 79, remembered for her stunning beauty, often surprisingly subtle acting, and a private life as dramatic as any she played, including eight marriages, two to the equally flamboyant Richard Taylor. I'm sorry, Richard Burton. Also dead last week at 73, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lanford Wilson. Now this.
Just cause you're black, boys think you lack. They laugh at you and scorn you too. What did I do to be so black and blue?
That Fats Waller classic was only one of many great songs first made famous by a nearly forgotten African-American performer named Ethel Waters. Her breakthrough career ran 50 years, including black and white vaudeville in the 1920s, an Oscar nomination in her own TV sitcom in the 1950s, and continuing roles until 1972, 5 years before she died.
Waters has a special meaning for me. At age 10, I flashed my first press pass from the Brooklyn Children's Museum Gazette to enter her brownstone around the corner from my apartment house the day a CBS truck parked outside, preparing for her appearance on the old Ed Murrow person-to-person show. But I didn't realize how important Waters was. Now her memory and legacy have been revived in a new biography called Heatwave, The Life and Career of Ethel Waters from HarperCollins. The author is NYU and University of Pennsylvania film historian Donald Bogle, and he joins us now for Your Ears Only. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
What were some of the other great American songs Waters made famous?
Am I Blue, that she sang in the 1929 film On With the Show, just when movies were really beginning to talk. She also, of course, introduced Stormy Weather, and many people associate that song with Lena Horne today, but Ethel Waters was the one who introduced it in 1933 when she appeared at the Cotton Club. And, of course, she also, the title of my book, Heatwave, the Irving Berlin song that she does a magnificent job with, and she performed it in the Broadway show, As Thousands Cheer, in 1933. And then there are songs like Happiness is a Thing Called Joe, which she does in Cabin in the Sky, and Taking a Chance on Love. So there are many, many songs that Ethel Waters really mastered and brought to the public. I should also say, David, that many people think of Ethel Waters, when they think of her, as an older, heavier woman. And as a young woman, she was known as Sweet Mama String Bean. And she was slender, sexy, had curves. And she sang a song that I like quite a bit called Shake That Thing, which is, I guess, rather raunchy, certainly for the time. And she does just a splendid job with that. She was a very versatile woman.
Like Louis Armstrong, her style set a standard for a lot of other singers, black and white, even as a younger, greater star named Lena Horne later admitted. Tell us about that influence, how you define her style.
Well, Ethel Waters' style is very interesting. You know, the women that Ethel Waters, as a young woman, really looked up to were the classic blues singers Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey. And Bessie Smith and Ma, what they did in their music was that when they performed, if they sang about love or heartache, or if they were singing about sex, they were always in the grip of the emotion itself. With Ethel Waters, when she performed, one, she was telling a story in song, and often she was removed from that deep emotional grip of the song. She was standing back and looking at herself and at her emotions and telling her listener about them. And it was a very interesting thing that she was able to do. The other thing about Ethel Waters that was really that added to her appeal quite a bit in the 20s when she first starts to record is her clarity. I mean, she had this really perfect diction, and again, in telling a story, and the diction, the clarity, stayed with her throughout her career. You know, she influenced, I mean, there were just so many people who were influenced by her and who felt her effects. I mean, someone like Dinah Washington, someone like Pearl Bailey. People forget that Pearl Bailey also sang a song like Two to Tango with the double entendres, which Ethel Waters had mastered as a young woman. Bing Crosby was an admirer of hers, so was Frank Sinatra, Mel Torme. The list just goes on and on of people who really just saw her great originality and never forgot it.
But as you say, in her later years, she was noted for Mammy Rolls Beulah, the first black TV sitcom star, and that troubled some other black performers and black critics. Talk about that and how she responded.
Well, one thing that happened to Ethel Waters after the Second World War, certainly there were changes in popular attitudes, taste. By the late 40s, early 50s, we were at the dawn of the civil rights movement. And Ethel Waters was, as a young woman, she was a race woman. She very much was a woman who believed in black causes and fighting for them. As she got older, I think she was a bit sort of disoriented by the changes that were coming about in American society. And so she continued to do a certain kind of role that was beginning to be seriously questioned. And Beulah, her role as this black maid working contentedly for a white family in this TV sitcom that comes on in 1950. It had been a radio show before, not with Waters, but when Waters did it, there was criticism, and Waters didn't like the criticism. But the thing that Waters was able to do with these roles was that she always brought to them a rich sense of humanity and the warmth. In her hands, they were really not caricatures. They weren't. She was able really to transcend what was going on in the scripts and sometimes even the way in which she was directed. There was something about Ethel Waters that went very deep inside her that would not really let herself become some kind of really gross or distorted caricature.
Donald Bogle is a film and African-American culture historian at NYU and the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is Heatwave, The Life and Career of Ethel Waters from HarperCollins. Now a bit more of her.
Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere, stormy weather. Just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time, the time.
Surviving Stormy Weather from our March 27th, 2011 broadcast, and Waters Persists. This month saw the world premiere of a theater piece about her, Ethel, in Philadelphia. Denton, Texas had a production of Ethel Waters, His Eyes on the Sparrow. And Charlotte, North Carolina had an exhibit of memorabilia from her years with the Billy Graham Crusade at the Billy Graham Theater there. Last week's news also included the sad ending of a more recent African-American singing star, the late Whitney Houston. The Los Angeles County Coroner reported that her autopsy indicated accidental death by drowning in a hotel bathtub following an apparent heart episode aggravated by use of cocaine and prescription medication, including the anti-anxiety drug Xanax, the muscle relaxer Flexeril, and anti-allergy Benadryl. I'm Rachel Murray. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, more Ethel Waters, introduced by another superstar, Diana Ross, on TV's Hollywood Palace in 1969, with the loss of Trayvon Martin also very much in mind.
When Irving Berlin wrote the score to the Broadway show, As Thousands Cheer, he composed one song especially for Ethel Waters. It's the story of a woman who just received word that her husband has been lynched by a frenzied mob. Here now, accompanied by Reginald Bean, is Miss Waters performing the unforgettable Supper Time.
Somehow I ain't able, 'cause that man of mine ain't coming home no more. Supper time, kids will soon be yelling for them. Supper time, how'll I keep from telling them that man of mine ain't coming home no more? How'll I keep explaining when they ask me where he's gone? How'll I keep from crying when I bring
this supper on. How can I remind them to pray at their humble board? How can I be thankful when they start to thank the Lord? Supper time, I set the table 'cause it's supper time. Somehow I ain't able 'cause that man of mine ain't coming home. No. Coming home no more.